This is Tim Sanders, author of Deal Storming, the secret weapon that can solve your toughest sales challenges. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, which was named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. My goal for this podcast is to help you discover new ideas about what's actually working in modern marketing. And don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything discussed in this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. Also, if you're listening to the show right now and you're not driving or operating dangerous machinery, please hop on Twitter and tell us where in the world you're listening from. My Twitter handle is MarketingBook. Today, we're joined by Tim Sanders, and we're going to talk about his latest book, Deal Storming, the secret weapon that can solve your toughest sales challenges. Tim Sanders is a technology pioneer, conference keynote speaker, and best-selling author of 4 other books, including the New York Times bestseller, Love is the Killer App: How to Win Business and Influence Friends, which has been translated into over a dozen languages. His other books are Today We Are Rich, The Likeability Factor, and Saving the World at Work. He's a co-founder of the research consultancy Deeper Media Incorporated. And little known fact, he once played in a rock band. Tim, congratulations on Deal Storming and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Well, thank you, Douglas. Glad to be with you.
We met in the summer of 2016 at CEB's Sales and Marketing Roundtable, and that was really exciting for me to be able to meet you and a number of other people who've been on this show. And I tell you what, it was, for me, it was like being a kid at NFL Fan Appreciation Day.
I know, right? First of all, I love CEB. I've loved their research for years. I found it ironic, though, that you and I were invited to a thought leader roundtable at a place where the challenger customer would tell you there is no such thing as a thought leader. I felt like we were the missionaries being rounded up around the pot, if you know what I mean.
Right. So that's right. I know certainly the challenger customer, they really take the notion of thought leadership to task. Well, or not so much that, they just show that it's not as effective as other approaches.
Correct.
Different interview. And actually, in the show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com, I'll include the interview I did with Pat Spinner. It really was quite a book. And you mentioned it. I think you got about 9 or 10 books at the end of this book recommended reading. And that you also included the Challenger sale.
So, you know, I specifically think that if you're in the world of smarketing, as Brent Adamson calls it, you really need to read the Challenger customer. If lead gen is one of your group's KPIs, you definitely need to read the Challenger customer.
I couldn't agree with you more. And as I mentioned in that interview, I just said, you know, to Pat that this book just completely rewired my brain, unlike the previous 50 that I had read. And there were even parts of it where I said, well, oh man, wait a minute. You mean maybe I've been doing a few things wrong, which is of course what they want you to think. And I thought, well, how do these guys know? And then they would follow it up by saying, well, this is based on 1,000 interviews or extensive research over the years into all our member companies. So it's like, oh, but anyway, so you live in Las Vegas, and I know you're from the Southwest, but do you live in Las Vegas so that you wouldn't have to travel there for all the conferences and conventions that you speak at?
That's a good part of it. I also escaped California after being there for 13 years. Uh-huh. And I love the cost of living. I love the convenience to the airport. I love the lifestyle here. It's just fantastic. Couldn't recommend it enough to people that do what I do.
Yeah. And Scott Stratton, who I know is one of your pals, and he mentioned to you when I interviewed him recently for the second edition of Unmarketing, he talked about, he just loves Las Vegas.
Oh, he's moving here, man. Him and his man bun are going to live here. And I want to say something, because I always try to return the favor. Scott Stratton has restored my faith in the Canadian parole system. here's a guy, you know, makes a couple of mistakes, pays his dues to society, and now he's a best-selling author speaker that's just tearing it up on the lecture circuit. Yeah, let him know I said that next time.
Oh, wow. Now I'm laughing, but I didn't know that he was actually
had some problems. Just ask him what no means no means, and he'll fill you in on that.
Okay. He's done really well, and I absolutely love the
books he's great.
He and his wife have written. So now, the book is called Deal Storming, and I looked at the very first line of the book, and it was, as follows. It was a cold, overcast day in the fall of 1997. And I didn't know if you were trying to make a joke, but there's this sort of meme that's been out there for years and years about the phrase, it was a dark and stormy night. And I thought, oh, yeah, maybe he's making a joke about that, because after having read your book, I know you wouldn't write a line like that, but I didn't know if you were winking at your audience when you said it was a cold, overcast day in the fall of 1990.
No. That's funny. No, I was just trying to put them, you know, in a time and in a place, because, you know, it was Dallas, Texas, downtown warehouse district, Mark Cuban's startup. You know, it was a very particular place in time that I wanted to put the reader, so they kind of understand, you know, this scrappy startup and why Don't Go Down Alone would be so important to that company's culture.
Right. Well, it certainly transported me there. Let me start with just one excerpt from the book and we'll keep going. And this is from just page 6. To write this book, I interviewed over 200 sales leaders from around the world, including chief revenue officers, sales vice presidents, directors, and process-oriented account executives, to compare notes and discover how they've used elements of deal storming to tackle sales issues of all types. In many cases, I found useful tools to add to my process, as well as examples of where creative collaboration led to breakthrough performance. Over and over again, I confirm that to be truly competitive in today's selling environment, every sales organization needs to implement a repeatable process to quickly problem solve their greatest challenges. So, Tim, I've got to ask the question everybody says, what is deal storming and is it the same thing as brainstorming?
Deal storming is when you bring a group of stakeholders together around a sales challenge and collaborate with a focus on execution. Deal storming differs from brainstorming, which I think turns into a goat rodeo more often than not, because deal storming is about finding a singular high-quality idea that constitutes the next play. In deal storming, you are very intentional about who you bring onto your team. You don't just round up 15 minds and throw them into a room to come up with ideas, right? In deal storming, we have a debate, and the debate will be about the quality of assumptions behind various ideas that people have for the next play. So, unlike brainstorming, we really do believe that we can have a candid conversation in that room. And the last big difference between brainstorming and deal storming is that we don't go for wild ideas. We go for sales innovations that look repeatable and scalable. In my experience, the only reason to think out of the box is to make the box stronger. And while brainstorming has been great when you've got to come up with 100 ideas for the Christmas party or whatever, it's a very frustrating experience for high-function people, specifically process-led people like sales and marketing leaders. And that was what I experienced very early in my career, were really bad brainstorming meetings. And that's when I kind of went on a journey to ask myself, what are the best of the best doing to solve the 100 challenges between you and the biggest deal in the history of your company? Because I'm telling you, Douglas, every high quality deal is 100 problems solved. And that's why rapid problem solving is your only competitive advantage in B2B.
Now, in reading the book, I could see really easily how this would work for larger companies. What's the smallest size company that where you've seen this work, or even where they've tried to apply some of these practices?
In the book, I talk about LGA, which is an architectural firm actually here in Las Vegas. I think there's 11, including their partners. They were working on a pretty big deal for an intellectually disabled facility here called Opportunity Village. And they were kind of stuck because even though they had the local edge in the bid process, they weren't going to win because they didn't have the inside information on how to create a value proposition around serving the intellectually disabled. They'd done visitor centers, never anything like this. So they found a competimate, and that's the first word of the podcast I want you to write down, competimate, who was an architectural firm in Greater Pittsburgh. They'd met at a conference. And this woman, Jane Rhodes, was an expert on intellectually disabled facilities. So they reached out to her, collaborated with her with an offer to help her when she wanted to work on visitor centers, because that was their area of expertise. She actually ended up going with them to the final sales presentation and participated in helping them close that deal. So what I tell small businesses all the time, and I spoke at SMPS last year about this, is that you can pick anybody to be on your deal storming team if either A, they have some expertise about your challenge, or B, they have a stake in the outcome, including the sales process. So you can have people that don't even work at your company who are competimates. Those are competitors that don't run into you in the market. Those could be OEMs if you're a reseller. Those could be partners that you rely on. It could just be colleagues you've met over LinkedIn. And I find the advantage for a small business is if you come up with a very innovative idea, you don't have to go through 13 levels of bureaucracy like some of my enterprise clients have had to go through to make a tweak to the marketing or sales go-to-market process.
So can you explain the problem that companies face that this approach solves?
Well, yeah, standing tall in the sales saddle. I mean, I find that too often when we approach complex sales and we get stuck somewhere in the process. So, you know, contact, conceive the value of the deal, convince the customer to make a change and pick us, contract. Those are the four levels. When we get stuck there, often it's not really collaboration, it's escalation, right? So the account executive goes to the district manager, and if it doesn't work, they escalate it to the regional VP. And if it's big enough, it makes its way to the VP's office. And if it's a real game changer, it goes all the way to the CRO or somebody else in the C-suite. And that's what they think teamwork is. And it doesn't work. I mean, it yields at best a 20-25% success ratio. We found that when you go wide instead of tall and leave out the big cheese, I don't like to see really, really senior people in collaboration meetings because we anchor around their ideas. They intimidate junior people from speaking up. They reduce information flow from outside of the sales department. When we go wide and we bring in 3 to 4 different business perspectives, we 3X our likelihood of solving that particular challenge in front of us. And that's what I think we need to see more of, is real collaboration as a first response instead of a last resort.
Okay, so we've talked about Las Vegas. I just got to share this. One movie kept coming to mind as I was reading this book, and it was Ocean's 11. Mm. And it was because that movie, where these very disparate team comes together, and they all have very different expertise, and they're solving a very specific problem, which is pulling off a heist inside a casino. And it was interesting because it goes into great detail, and your book goes into great detail about all the different roles and some of the pitfalls and, you know, how it's done and how it's not done. So I was wondering if we could back up though and talk a little bit more about sales complexity, because I'm wondering if not everybody fully appreciates just how much more complex sales have become. Can you kind of remind folks or walk them through this complex world of sales we're dealing with that some people may be in denial about?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's start with the first one. You can't get in the front door anywhere. No one is answering your emails. Social selling was a hacker stopgap, worked pretty well to jump out of the inbox and into the news feed, but that's going to peter out just like everything else when we kind of get desensitized as buyers to someone liking and commenting on our stuff.
Right. We'll ruin everything ultimately.
And no one answers, you know, our phone calls anymore. No one returns our phone calls. Prospecting is a nightmare, especially in B2B, especially when we're talking about supplier acquisition. Those buyers, as we know from CEB, like to do self-service when it comes to problem discovery, alternative discovery. They're somewhere between 57 and 80% through the process before we ever talk to them. So we're faced with unteaching as a great challenge. We got to deal with that. And then to make matters worse, there is no more person to close. I got to tell you, Douglas, it makes me lose my mind when I hear these sales trainers talk about, you know, 5 steps to the perfect close. There is no close. There is consensus building. It doesn't work that way. You don't use leverage like Glengarry Glen Ross. You're a quarterback in the new world of sales, and you organize mobilizers on the buy side to defeat the status quo. That's really hard. And the issue is that there are so many different people who are part of the decision-making process. So we have to lose this idea of decision makers and begin to think of the buying web. So there's a web at a buyer, and that web involves end users, budget holders, concerned third parties. Think about the CISO on all cloud business, There's influencer know-it-alls. CEB calls those teachers. There's procurement.
Charitably.
Uh-huh. And then there's micromanagers. And you're looking at anywhere from 6 to 30 of those in the web on a deal. And here's the point. You don't even get in front of half of them as a sales rep, no matter how strategic your offering is. And so that creates an incredible level of complexity that puts a real challenge on you to be creative. And here's the thing. When we did our research at Deeper Media in pipeline audit, and you know, Douglas, everybody does pipeline audit, we looked for different things. And what we've learned is that if you go talk to a sample size of a company's dead stuff in the pipeline, about half of the people you talk to basically said, we went back to what we were doing. I just ran out of time. I had to get back to work. You see, almost no one you ever sell to has buyer on their business card. Okay. They got a job, and finding suppliers is almost an extracurricular activity. So what happens is the complex sale puts so much stress on them too, to organize and mobilize. At some point, if we take too long and the cycle's like 9 months, a year or whatever, they just bonk out on the whole thing. There's some internal alarm clock that goes off that says, I got to get back to work. And so speed is just as important as value in the new world of business. And I emphasize it so much. We've just got to get faster. We've got to be completely obsessive about reducing sales cycle. If there was one KPI that I would tell the sales leaders of the world to get really freaky over, it is reduction of sales cycle year over year by 10%, no excuses, nothing else is accepted. I talk to businesses that have never thought about compressing their sales cycle. They're just like, that's what it is. It takes 6 months to sell our stuff. And I'm like, yeah, but if you take a look at disruptive technology, a big part of B2B disruption, especially in technology, are people that come in with an SDR demo model that closes deals in a week on a credit card. And that is your enemy in the world of sales. So that's why speed is so important in approaching this rising complexity.
You also talk about how so many products and services are becoming increasingly technical and just the explosion of competitors.
I mean, you need a weight belt to carry around all the onboarding documentation for half of the stuff you buy today. I mean, like even at the world of HR services, you'd be surprised at how highly technical, simple things like training have become. Like a learning management system, an LMS, is like an SAP installation or a Siebel. Oh, I'll use a word here, a Siebel systems integration, right? Same thing goes for marketing. Think about how complex the technology products you buy now to make marketing efficient are. It's crazy. Think about how you have to look at video advertising, not just from an optimization standpoint, but all the back end work. I mean, everything is complex. There's no more simple products. We don't carry around a bag of gadgets anymore. We're expected to build integrated systems, and that's what makes the world very difficult for today's account executive in B2B.
But as you say in the book, these problems are not insurmountable. And I guess you must run into folks
absolutely
who think
not.
They are insurmountable.
I mean, if you go wide and you champion the concept that ideas come from anywhere, and you look at the whole sales process as one sprint, the impossible is merely difficult. We have gone into deals, Deeper Media has, where they would estimate the chance of success at 5 to 10% just because of everything that had happened up to date or their perception that they were actually competing against another company instead of the status quo. And we've closed those deals. And we've closed those deals in a way that surprised them. And we did it by just systematically moving through those four stages, what I called sprints, little one-week episodes that we would go through. And what's really crazy is that some of the breakthrough ideas came from outside of sales, and they came from very unlikely people. They'd come from sales enablement. They'd come from somebody in lead gen. We had one company figure out the secret sauce for a really important presentation by talking to a recruiter in HR who actually had a crisp explanation of what that company did.
Well, they were probably pretty darn close to the buyer persona themselves.
Well, they're recruiting candidates who always ask, I'm confused, what do you guys do?
Oh, that's right. That was another part of the book where you talked about how when you're pitching a certain type of company, let's say you're pitching you're pitching an HR product. Well, go talk to your own HR person.
Exactly.
they probably have some insights.
Right.
But there was another thing that you talked about. I think somebody at Microsoft may have told you this. What do you mean when you say that you should include people from the land of no?
Oh, absolutely. So in sales world, the reason they make collaboration outside of sales world a last resort is that you've got to work with the land of no or the world of slow. Okay, land of no. Land of no is engineering that is asked to do customization. Land of no is finance and operations that are asked to work on product discounting or scale discounting. World of slow is going to be customer service and marketing. And that's not me. I didn't make that up. I heard that so much. You'd either say, yeah, I don't want to go talk to the land of no. Really? We're going to bring information technology into this deal at this point? They're just going to come in and say no. They always say no. And what I've learned is that, and I learned this from Mark Schmitz, who's now at SuccessFactors. He was at SAP Cloud and before that Ariba. He taught me in his experience that you can bring in the revenue management group. And if you bring them in early when it's still a sales challenge and not later when you're contracting or in a delivery crisis, he said, quote, you can turn the police into the pep squad. Because the issue oftentimes when we're way down the road on a deal and we get told no, part of it is because we didn't involve those people in the beginning, so they have no stake in the game. All they have is policy. And to quote one of my favorite authors from his book, Rework, Friedman, he said, you know, a policy is something that we created a long time ago because of something bad that happened that will never happen again. He called it the scar tissue of an organization. And frequently, that's what the land of no is in an organization. But if you bring them in as a team player and let them participate in solving the problem, they get super involved in the process. They take some ownership of it, and they're willing to fight for you to change precedent.
So let's go on to video games. Explain how winning a deal these days in this fast-moving, highly complicated world of B2B sales is like winning modern video games, not the kind that we may have played as kids.
You know, the analogy I use is that when I started selling, I sold radio spots in the 1970s. If you were to use an analogy of what kind of game is that, if you were playing, it's like Pong, hand-eye coordination, repetition, bag of quarters. You have a home console, you're going to champion the game because you sold belly to belly. It was a very simple process, right? Find a prospect, make the pitch, get the check.
They didn't have a lot of options.
You know, everything was easy. We didn't even contracts. You got the check. That was your contract, you know? But today it's gotten incredibly complex. And when you think about the four levels, I mentioned it before, make contact with the prospect, conceive the win-win value proposition, convince them to change and pick you, contract the deal. Those are four levels of the game. And it's like playing Halo today to get through those four levels on a B2B quality sale. Every single level you'll challenge. In fact, I would say that there's levels within levels. Like you'll go through 10 levels of contact to actually figure out what the buying web is at an organization and get enough information to go to the conceive level and figure out what you're gonna sell them, right? So it is like a video game. And the reason I use the analogy is because you have to think, how many lives do we have left in this game? Because remember, the buyer's gonna buy bonk out at some point, or their company's going to get bought, or something's going to happen. So how many lives do we have left? And especially if you think about today, how we play multiplayer online, how well am I playing with my team? Is somebody looking out for my back? You know, in the military, they call it got your six. Like, who's got my six? And that's why I think in sales, we have to remember that you don't get any credit for losing the deal by yourself. I always tell salespeople, you know, what's 20% of zero? It's zero. Right. And so collaboration is something I think that is make or break for an account executive trying to make quota in the new world.
So can you explain the similarities between, okay, we talked about video games. Now let's move on to movies, all these entertainment things. But the similarities between making a movie and landing a big deal or maybe even saving a big account. You talk quite a bit about Pixar and their very first feature film, Toy Story.
It's a breakthrough moment for me to meet Ed Catmull, president of Pixar. He wrote a really good book, by the way, called Creativity Incorporated or Creativity Inc. I loved it a lot. But anyway, I met him over a decade ago, and I'm such a fan of Toy Story. And I was just talking to him about his VP of creative, John Lasseter. What a genius idea John had to make a movie using their technology about a boy and his toys, told from the toy's point of view. And I remember Catmull said to me, that was a troublesome idea from the very beginning. It's like almost every assumption was wrong. We didn't have the power to render a movie full length in our computers. Didn't exist at the time. We couldn't make them lifelike. We had to build 700 facial controllers to try to do that. We had no experience writing scripts. And then he reveals to me, as he outlines in the book, their distribution partner, Disney, shut the movie down 9 months into production on what they call Black Friday. And the movie was left for dead. And the only way that Catmull saves the movie through grit and determination is he said, we got out of the movie making silo. Producers, editors, videographers, special effects artists. And we went wide. He built something at Pixar called the Brain Trust. He brought in people that had knowledge of markets, like figuring out how to think about the adult market, you know, not just the kids market, so they could expand. They had to think about different technology partners. They brought in like Sun Microsystems that figured out a really cunning solution to do daisy chaining of Spark servers. And this is a long time ago, okay? He brought in psychologists. He brought in puppeteers to give them a different way to think about what lifelike really means. He said, Toy Story wasn't a great idea. It was a horrible idea, but it was audacious. He said Toy Story was 1,000 problems solved. And you can imagine, Douglas, this is when the whole penny drops for me on the whole process, where I got that when you're out trying to work on a quality deal, it's like trying to make Toy Story. And you're going to get stuck. And you're going to have Black Friday if you try to do it on your own or just stay inside the sales silo. You got to build a brain trust. You got to go wide. And you have to engage in conversations that Pixar calls plussing, where we build on each other's ideas as opposed to criticizing them per se. One of the things they do at Pixar, and I started to use this in my consulting, is when a high-function performer doesn't like an idea, before he or she offers what they think the flaw in the idea is, the leader should challenge them to improve that idea first or combine it with another idea on the table. Because we found that improvements or hybrids constituted almost 2 out of 3 winning ideas in complex sales challenges.
So let's talk about marketers. What role have you seen marketers play in deal storming, and how have they played a positive role, and what can they be doing, and why should they care about this for those marketers who are thinking, hey, this is a sales thing?
Well, you know, everybody's in sales now. That's why I call it smarketing. I mean, you talk to me, you talk to, like I said, all my B2B clients, you go talk to marketing, guess what? Lead gen is part of their problem now. It didn't used to be that way, folks. Marketing used to create brand and demand. Today, they have KPIs to generate leads, and it has a lot of impact on their budgets and their personal performance reviews. So they're in the grease on this thing already. Here's what I would say. Marketing has an opportunity to build a collaborative culture by reaching across the aisle as often as possible to ask, what are the big challenges in the pipeline? How can we help? Because let me tell you where I think marketing can make the biggest deal. In the first and third level, when it comes to contact, or what we call prospecting, they can make a huge deal with creative thinking because of how they're wired. But in the convince level of the sale, where you're trying to defeat the status quo and establish your company as the unique winner, you have to figure out ways to show them, not tell them. Today's masterful selling organization, they are artists, not quants. Okay, people resist facts and figures, but they lean into the correct illustration, the correct story. One of the things I would say, just put an asterisk next to this one in show notes. If marketing wants to change the game, stop producing case studies and start producing stories, because the two are not the same.
Amen.
A story is the hero's, if the story is a hero's journey, which mostly it is, guess who the hero is? It ain't you and your company. You're Yoda. The hero was the customer who went on a journey to accomplish something. They resisted the call. They faced struggles. They met mentors like you and your company who had tools. It almost didn't work. They pulled it off. They repaired relationships, and it became the new world at work. That is the story. And when you tell that story, you're going to activate a certain part of the prospect's brain that's going to do two things. Remember the story so they can repeat it, unlike all your numbers. And believe you and see themselves inside that story. And that's where I think we activate mobilizers today who are kind of on the fence. So here's a couple of data points, though, now that I've said don't use data. what's now called CSO Insights used to be, Miller Hyman Research Institute. Tamara Schenk, great thought leader. They did a study in 2014, I'm sure you've seen, that talked about the world-class selling organization. And when they took a look at what they all had in common, they had the habit of conscious collaboration, especially between sales and marketing in pursuit of major deals. And in preparation for my talk at Dreamforce, we did a study, and I'm going to send you a link to post in show notes where people can download these slides. And just for those of you listening, you can just go to timsanders.com/Dreamforce to get it. But anyway, what we did is we talked to over 150 companies, and we talked both sides of the aisle. So we talked to a leader in sales and a leader in marketing. And at over 30 of those companies, we talked directly to the CEO. We asked a couple of questions. One of them, is marketing a service provider or are they a partner to sales? A service provider means that basically sales is an internal customer and they have KPIs for delivery, but there's really no downside if sales fails. Partner means their budgets are often conjoined. Success is tied between the two. There's a high involvement of marketing in things like a sales incentive. And on the flip side, sales is heavily involved in voice of the customer. Okay.
Maybe service level agreement tied in there somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. So of the companies that responded, not surprisingly, if you look at the pie chart, only 19% were partner. And the other, the remainder, unless they didn't know, which a couple didn't really know, but 78% were absolutely providers to internal customers, okay? And that didn't surprise me. But what did surprise me is the closing ratio, what they call high-quality deals. So the high-quality closing ratio was over 40%. And for the provider, it was barely above 20%. And what I found the most interesting in our research is that when you looked at the sales cycle for complex deals, usually in technology or business process outsourcing, if you were just treating marketing like a service provider, very reactive kind of approach, your sales cycle was around 220 days on the average on a complex deal. And we found if you were a partner, you took 60 days out of the sales cycle on the average for the same type of deals. That's pretty amazing. I mean, if you told me that if I'd bring marketing in and treat them like a partner, I could take 2 months out of the cycle after I know what I know about what's dead in the pipeline and why it died, I would really rethink the relationship between the sales and marketing group, and I would make sure that they met together, they celebrated together, and they succeeded and failed together. And for CEOs and CROs listening, you need to get after this right away, because if you don't, the competitor who's going to beat you in the market will, because I see this as the most important movement right now. We've got to get CMO and CSO reporting to the same person.
And these aren't difficult dots to connect based on what you just explained, but also there was another book on the show called Aligned to Achieve by Tracy Eiler and Andrea Austin, who are the marketing and the sales head at Inside View.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
A terrific book. One of my favorites. And in it, they talked about, I think it was the Serious Decision research that very clearly shows that you have or much faster growth and higher profitability, like 15 to 20% on each one of those numbers when they're aligned.
Yep. And I think that alignment is largely culturally based. I mean, I've seen people try to do it with comp and recognition, and that's a hatchety way to do it. You can make it work like that. But if you can build a culture that collaboration is an instinct, that's the key. And the alignment comes from success stories, right? So what I think about all the time when I talk to marketing groups is I say, go talk to your sales leaders and find out what challenges they're facing right now. I don't mean like dealing with an objection or differentiating in the market. Those are high level. I mean, at the account level, talk to me about something where it's big, it's strategic, and you're stuck. And then what marketing can do is not just participate in those deal storms, they can serve the role of information master. And what I mean by this is they can manage all the information that's distributed previous to the deal storm meetings. I call those deal briefs. They can manage the information that is exchanged during that meeting and the reporting that follows. And then if the deliverable has a creative bent, they can manage that process. And by pulling through the information from the beginning to the end, they're going to generate a lot of social proof of leadership. They're going to become a critical partner to the entire process. And I think they're going to get energized. And the reason why we like marketing here is because they have the unique ability to distill a lot of voices into a singular voice. Because I mentioned Goat Rodeo before, you know, that is the downside, you know, when you're trying to bring in different perspectives into a business meeting is you're really having a hard time sometimes distilling different voices at the end of the day because the client doesn't need to know your deal storming. The client needs to know that you've come up with a solution and they need a single voice. Marketing can play a critical role in that throughout the process.
One other benefit that you didn't talk about too much in the book because you had to explain the whole process and so forth, but was it brought to mind the quote, I think attributed to General Eisenhower, where he talked about he thought plans were useless, but the planning process was invaluable.
Yeah, I agree with that.
You talked about how over the course of, you know, doing this for years and helping lots of companies, you've seen what happens is not only do they maybe get the deal, or they keep that key account, but they start to introduce a lot of improvements to their whole way of selling and mm-hmm. servicing accounts.
Yeah, so I love that. What happens, and I've experienced this, is in sales, we have a set of constraints, things that do not work or we cannot do. And we have a set of best practices, greatest hits, things that always work. And what happens to sales, and it happens to every group, is both of them become obsolete. Companies do not become obsolete. The constraints they operate under become obsolete and they get as disrupted as a result. People do not become obsolete. Their greatest hits go out of style, right? So when you bring together multiple perspectives, what you're doing is you're combining a different set of constraints and greatest hits. And sometimes you realize as a sales leader, when you bring in the right people, that you're operating under the total wrong set of constraints. You're like, well, we can't automate demos. If we automate demos, sales volume is going to go down. Somebody comes in that has a different experience because they actually bought software. They're on the ops side, changes your way of seeing the world. I've seen this. And you just change your go-to-market strategy and you double-digit grow the next year. I've seen it. The other thing I've seen is that if you follow this process, and it's a 7-step process, and you know, it's like you build the team, you recruit the team. Step number 3 is you prepare the team. I found that when an account executive in collaboration with someone from marketing, when they take the time to put together that 2-3-page deal brief, help us understand the nature of the challenge, the influence map of who's involved, what we've tried so far and how it's worked, and information about the prospect company, almost 1 out of 5 times, that process solved the sales challenge. Because we weren't really asking ourselves, what's the root cause of our challenge? We were trying to attack symptoms. It was like whack-a-mole. They're not calling us back after the presentation. Let's bring a group together and figure out a discount offer. No, let's figure out the root cause of the problem. That's why I think a good deal storm meeting puts about 15 minutes into discussing the real problem behind the symptom. And that's where I think a lot of discoveries are made about a better marketing and sales process.
Yes. And there's one quote in the book where you talked about finding the answer is defining the question.
Yeah. So a problem well-defined is a problem half-solved. And so one of the things we love to do is take a page out of Toyota Lean, the 5 whys.
Oh, please explain that.
So the 5 in quality, I come from quality. Years and years ago, I worked for Ed Deming and I come from the quality movement. So when we were trying to figure out—
You worked for Edward Deming?
Yeah, I was an attaché. I carried his bag, so I was not a consultant or a teacher, but I was young, dude.
Holy
I was in my 20s.
Holy
so it was,
cow.
It was a great experience that right out of grad school. So I was very aware that quality is not achieved through inspection. Just like sales process isn't improved by postmortem, okay? Quality is statistically designed throughout the process of manufacturing. I learned that, you know, at a visceral level. Well, anyway, so this goes all the way back to Toyota, and they figured out specifically around brake variance, they figured out the value of the 5 whys. So basically, if you ask why do we have this problem and you get an answer, and then you get a circumstance or an excuse, and then you ask why that exists. If you get to the 5th why in the process, 80% of the time you found the root cause of the problem. at Toyota, they thought the brake variance had to do with infrequency of calibration, that the machines, the lathes naturally moved apart. And then when they went, they dug down, they found out that the reason that the calibration wasn't done enough is because there wasn't budget. The reason there wasn't budget is Tokyo didn't understand the cost of rework. The reason they didn't understand the cost of rework is that no one from quality had ever presented at a board of directors meeting. Bada bing, bada boom, they solved the problem. Five whys is a manager's best friend when you have an itch that we're not really talking about the root cause problem in the room.
Yes, and I drive a Toyota with 175,000 miles on it.
There it is.
It just keeps going. I can't buy a new one because that would, so you see, it works.
Yeah.
So, Tim, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
If there was one thing I'd want you to take away from the book, is the next time you get stuck on a challenge, whether it's sales, whether it's marketing, just don't go down alone. You'll find someone who's going to help you dramatically improve your chance of success. And connected to that idea, and I want to just kind of bridge to, you know, the higher level idea behind the whole book, because the book is a subversive read that's designed to get marketing operations more involved in the sales process. There's a subversiveness behind all of this. I believe that we need to build relationships across our company and stop eating lunch with our own groups and being so clicky. You know, that was a huge thing that happened in my career back at Yahoo after Cuban sold the company and I showed up there. I noticed that we were all in cliques, and no wonder we didn't collaborate. I never ate lunch with sales from that day forward. I learned the old saying is true: the best time to build relationships is long before you need them. So be available to other groups to hear what challenges they're working on, volunteer your expertise to help them, and build your own web of relationships, and collaboration will be a no-brainer for you in an organization.
Well said. What books have inspired your work and career? I know you mentioned several in your book.
As an author, I'm as eclectic as Prince or Elvis Costello. So, you know, I've written across the gamut,
yes.
Right? I'm just very, very eclectic. So I would say.
So it doesn't mean marketing or sales books, just what books?
People ask me, what do you write about? I said, I write about how to be more successful. Okay, here's a few. Love by Leo Biscaglia. One of the most important books I've ever read. I just read it again over my winter vacation. In that book, he reads a little poem. I love this book. It's about the nature of real relationships. And it's from the life of Don Juan. And it basically says, to paraphrase it, there are a million paths. Any one of them can potentially lead to success. But the question for you is, does your path have a heart? Because if it does, then it's a good path. I tell this to everyone who's concerned when a bad guy shows up in the world and is successful for whatever reason. That's his path. That doesn't need to be your path. But if your path has a heart, I guarantee as a leader, as a manager, it's going to be a good path. So that book's been huge to me. For deal storming, towards the end of the finish line, I got to say I was very influenced by General Stanley McChrystal's book, Team of Teams. I read a galley of that when I was just about to finish deal storming, and it kind of rewired the way I thought about it. Basically, what General says is it takes a network to defeat a network. And when we think about the complex world of sales with organized buying teams, that's never been more relevant. For long-term value, I would say the most helpful book I've read as a speaker is the book Customer Capitalism by Sandra Vandermeulen. It's a very expensive book. It's almost $60 via Wiley, which means it's out of print. That's Wiley's shorthand for out of print. Fantastic book. And what it basically says is that as a marketer, you need to look not at the solution you provide, but the customer activity cycle. What is the customer trying to do? And they use a great case study of the Mercedes smart car launch in Europe. And they realized that they don't sell a car. They don't sell a driving experience. They were selling short haul mobility. And that was the customer activity cycle. And what they realized is that the car is just a piece of the puzzle. There's everything else, isn't there? There's driver education if you're a teen. There's insurance. There's repair. There's detailing. There's rental when the smart car can't work on the Autobahn. And they realized those are all value gaps. So as a company, they realized they needed to define the customer activity space and surround it with solutions through partnership or native production. And if you do that, you close your value gaps, and you create what they call customer lock-on, because customer lock-on makes customers more valuable over time, unlike lock-in, which creates diminishing returns in CRM. So anyway, I love the high-level thinking about that book, because what it really challenges people is to think differently about what they do, and it reminds me of the old Peter Drucker quote, right? No one wants to buy a quarter-inch drill bit. What do they want?
They want a hole.
No, they want artwork on the wall. Yes, exactly. Oh, they want a hole. And so we got to stop being the tool.
Uh-huh.
Instead, become the master of the activity cycle. That's been a big think book for me. I love it. And as the years go by, I've seen so many companies implement this, and it's been a game changer for each and every one.
Wow, I did not know that book. I am definitely going to have to look into it. Are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or are looking forward to reading? Maybe some other galleys that you've gotten?
So there's a couple. I mean, I loved the book I received a couple of months ago, Robert Cialdini's Persuasion, right? That's a great book.
Yeah. Oh, so, I got the chance to interview him for the show.
Yeah. So that's a great book. I love that. That book was mind-bending.
Yes.
There is another one that my son just gave it to me, and it's called Subliminal. And it's really, really good at understanding how subtext and subnarrative is working in the new world of 24/7 mobile social. And that's a little book, but I like that one. And then I would have to say that Jonah Berger's Invisible Influencers, which I got late last year, was also a game changer. You know, he's a really big thinker. He's the guy that really helped me understand what it means to, quote, go viral. I mean, you know, everybody, it was one of those things that nobody really understood how to do it. And it was like luck. And it's not luck. It's not luck at all. It's about creating a share coefficient that is faster than decay. Period. And so Berger in Invisible Influencers does the same thing for us to help rethink influencer marketing, which is not working.
Yes, I got the honor of interviewing him last year too. I'll make sure to link up in the show notes the interviews with both Cialdini and Berger. They were definitely mind-bending.
You drop more names than Drake.
And now I got Tim Sanders. I can stop. No.
There you go.
You know, I'm like a guy, you know, the guys that read all the sports websites and watch all the sports shows and collect all the signed sports memorabilia. That's me, except it's with authors of marketing and sales books.
So, there you go, man.
So there you go. So how best can listeners learn more about you and your book?
Visit timsanders.com. You can download a free chapter of Deal Storming at dealstorming.net/free. That's dealstorming.net/free. I'm on all the social networks at Sanders Says.
Great. And we will make sure to include links to all of those things in the show notes for this episode at marketingbookpodcast.com. The name of the book is Deal Storming, the secret weapon that can solve your toughest sales challenges. The author is Tim Sanders. Tim, thank you very much for being on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Absolutely, Douglas. My pleasure.
And that closes the book on episode 108 of the Marketing Book Podcast. Links to everything linkable in the interview you just listened to are at marketingbookpodcast.com, and that's also where you can sign up for the Marketing Book Podcast newsletter so you never miss an episode. Let's meet in person. If you're in the Raleigh, North Carolina area, I'll be speaking to the Triangle Marketing Club on February 28th about the 7 concepts from 100 marketing and sales books every marketer needs to know. Want me to come speak to your group? All I need is a bus ticket, a bar tab, and a hotel room. To contact me, just go to marketingbookpodcast.com and leave a message or connect with me on LinkedIn. My name again is Douglas Burdett, or send me a tweet at my Twitter handle, marketingbook. I look forward to hearing from you. And please join us next time as we welcome Ken Rutsky to the show to talk about his new book, Launching to Leading, how B2B market leaders create flash mobs, martial parades, and ignite movements. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.